Thank you. Before we begin, a disclaimer. A disclaimer. Please, I ask you to pay attention. I am a mathematician. I am not a rabbi. I do not represent any organization. I write articles in the Jewish press, but I do not get any money for them. So what you are going to hear is my opinion. You may accept it, and you may reject it. But it's my opinion. I speak with no special authority. The purpose of the talk is not to bash Orthodoxy, because there is much that is wonderful about Orthodoxy. The purpose of my talk really is to do an honest evaluation of our world, and where there are things that I feel are wrong, perhaps you'll agree with me, and perhaps it will lead to some improvement. Now, what I'm going to say will not always coincide with what I have begun calling recently politically correct Haredi ideology. There exists in certain circles an ideology that I could call to some extent revisionism. There are Holocaust deniers, of course, but there also exist Orthodox deniers. People who simply deny historical fact and events because those historical facts do not fit with their view of the way they think the world should be, and they want to remake the past to fit that view. They are willing to deny historical facts. Let me give you a couple of examples. I'm sure that virtually everyone here has heard of Zundel Berman from the Sfarim. Zundel was one of the first Talmidim in the Lakewood Yeshiva when Rav Aaron Kutler Zecher Tzadik Livracha came to America. He was from the first. Zundel told me that he heard with his own ears the following statement from Rav Aaron: 3 years in Kollel is enough for anyone. Now, I was talking with somebody in the store here in Borough Park, and I mentioned that to him, and there was a fellow standing there who wasn't involved in the conversation who said, "It's a lie." I said, "What do you mean it's a lie?" "It's a lie," he says to me. Rav Aaron would never say such a thing. He would never say that. Are you telling me that Zundel Berman lied? Yes, he lied. For what purpose? He lied. It's a lie. It's a lie. It's a lie. Someone else told me that Rav Huttner said that 5 years in coal was enough for anyone. Presumably that's also, quote unquote, a lie. It wasn't a lie. Now, it may be that one can argue that that was an appropriate statement at the time that Rav Aaron made it, and it may not be appropriate for today. But nonetheless, it's a fact. He said the statement. In our world today, there is a lot of positive, and there is some negative. I ask you to listen carefully. Listen to the pluses, and also not focus exclusively on the minuses. A wise man once said that there are three things in this world, only three things. The things you think you say, the things other people think you say, and the things you really say. So please, listen carefully. I don't intend to make any blanket statements, and if I leave out the word some or part of, etc., then put it in. Every single group contains its good and fine elements, and unfortunately, there can be some not so good elements. Let's begin with one area in which I think that the Jewish community really has no equal, and that is in the area of Chesed. Actually, I wrote an article. In fact, I have a list, if you're interested, of articles that are related to the things I'm going to talk about here today.
Don't give it out.
Not now?
Okay, we'll give it out later. Right. Most of them are links on a website of mine. But I wrote an article in the Hamodia a while ago entitled "Giving Credit Where Credit is Due." If you open up the Hamodia any week and you look in the classified section, you will see at least a page and a half, a full page and a half, of various chesed organizations. It's unbelievable. It's absolutely mind-boggling. In addition to the usual borrowed chairs for a simcha and the dresses and suits and this and that, there are ads such as willing to take people with Alzheimer's disease for a ride to the water, to the park, just out. Can arrange for a video transmission of a simcha if a close relative is confined to the hospital or at home. Let's say it's an uncle, it's an aunt, it's a grandparent, they can't attend, say, a chasana. People will set up a closed circuit video so that you can see it. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. There's one that says, don't undergo surgery until you have a second reading on your x-rays. Free second reading of x-rays. And it goes on and on and on. And unfortunately, the vast majority of these things are completely unnoticed by the outside world. Completely unnoticed. There is something that did make the news, actually made the New York Times. There is a store called Bobby's Place that's run by the Schick family, in which poor people can take their children and get clothes before Yontif. The finest, nice, beautiful clothes. No cost. Absolutely free. It's an amazing operation. And this family runs this. They underwrite it. They raise money for it. It's a marvelous thing. It's stupendous. It's stupendous. The tzedakah that's given. Also, an amazing thing. If a tragedy occurs, people give. People give. On the other hand, I have to point out the following. With, unfortunately, all too much regularity, we see an article about a young husband or a young wife who died in an accident or from a disease, and then people are collecting money. What I always think about is, you mean they didn't have any life insurance? You have 7, 8, 9, 10 children, and you don't have any life insurance? You not, after all, it's not even cost effective. Forget about anything else. If you have to raise $50,000, $100,000, and I mean if we're talking about somebody who passed away young, and you have years of support, and then the survivor becomes literally a ward of the public. They don't have a penny. Constantly looking for handouts. We need a comprehensive program so that young people have life insurance. And there are now movements afoot to do this. But it's really just beginning. It is astounding to me that we have not had an international organization that has developed plans so that every young couple can have life insurance. A friend of mine who's very involved in this said to me, it's a better present than the gold watch or the pearls at the chuppah. Give them a life insurance policy, one for him and one for her. And you know something? He's right. He's right. He's absolutely right. We need it. We need it. At the same time that we have all of this chesed, we also see a phenomenon in the Jewish world in which, in certainly some homes, children are not being raised by their mothers or their fathers. The mothers and the fathers are forced to work. Let's be honest, it's expensive to be an observant Jew. It's very expensive. We live in neighborhoods that are expensive. The cost of shoes, the cost of clothes, the cost of food, the cost of yeshiva tuition, camp. Even, we're not talking about families that are living in some sort of fancy, high lifestyle. Simply being able to meet what I'll call reasonable obligations is an astounding burden. And very often, it's necessary for both parents to work. There may be no other way. There may be no other way. But then who is left to raise the children? I see on the block that I live on, I see children that are being raised by Russians or by Gentiles who simply are not imparting the Torah values that we would like our young children to get. These people, as nice as they may be, as concerned as they may be for the children that they're taking care of, cannot impart to those children what a parent can, because they don't have the knowledge. It's interesting that, you know, going to work costs money too. I don't know if you're aware of that. Many people don't realize that when you go to work, you need, in general, certain special clothing for work. You have to pay transportation. You have various other expenses. You have the babysitter expense, if that's involved, or the caretaker, whatever it may be. And it may well be that if you do the cheshbon, that the whole difference is $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 a year. Is it worth it? People have to ask themselves. It's not up to me to make judgments. But people should think about this at least and say, is it really worth my leaving my children in the hands of someone who obviously is not going to do as good a job, is not going to do as good a job, rather than me doing it? Now, I am not saying that women should not work outside of the home. There are some women who are content to stay home, and they're happy with it. But there are certainly a lot of other women who are not. There's a story that I heard about a fellow who had a disagreement with his wife. She wanted to go to work, and he didn't want her to go to work. He wanted her to stay home and take care of the children. So he went to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and he asked Rabbi Yaakov, and Rabbi Yaakov said, she shouldn't go to work. She should stay home and take care of the children. He came back and said, Rabbi Kamenetsky said that you should stay home. Well, she wasn't about to just take that flying down. She went to Rabbi Kamenetsky, and she came back and she said, Rabbi Kamenetsky said, I should go to work. So the husband went back to Rabbi Yaakov and said, what's going on? You told me no. He told her yes. So Rabbi Yaakov said the following to him. He said, some women need to get out. True, the ideal situation would be that if she could stay home and do it all the time. If your wife only wants to go to work part-time, she will be a better mother if she goes to work. Therefore, she should go to work. So this is a complex issue, but nonetheless, it is an issue that seems to be ignored. Every once in a while, we hear stories of children who are taken to church by Polish maids on Sundays when they themselves go to church when the parents go. We're talking about kids with payers. We're talking about, you hear these stories. It is certainly something for the community to think about. The next topic that I want to touch upon is the topic of kashrus. Now, we live in an amazing time. There are literally hundreds of agencies that supervise products. In fact, they claim that if you walk into any supermarket anywhere in the United States, we're not talking here in Borough Park, we're not talking in Flatbush, we're talking out in the middle of nowhere in the Midwest, you will find at least a third of the products on the shelves with some sort of hashgacha. It's unbelievable. Who would have believed 60, 70 years ago that there would be national kashrus organizations like the Orthodox Union? Who would have believed? I spent a year at West Point as a visiting professor there. And before I came, I was shown around. They took me in to show me the dining hall at West Point. They feed something like 5,000 cadets in one shot, all at the same time. It's quite an amazing. On the table is something called cadet ketchup with an ogre. Cadet ketchup. Who would have believed such a thing 50, 60, 70 years ago? Unheard of. Unheard of. Unheard of. It's there. So we live in a marvelous time. We live in a marvelous time. But unfortunately, the public is not particularly astute very often. What do I mean by that? People seem to be content to know that the word glot or the words chol of Yisrael are associated with it, and that's enough. That's enough. Is it glot? Is it chol of Yisrael? Indeed, there's a website, Kosher Caterer, who advertises the following. Our meat is not just kosher. It's not just glot kosher. It is glot kosher Hasidish Shechita. And then there is a statement that we feel that Hasidim are more medactic and more careful in mitzvahs. Now, by the way, I should point out that it's not just glatt kosher. It's not just glatt kosher Hasidic sheep, but it also has halal, the Muslim hashgach on it too. So it's super kosher. Can't be better than that, right? Can't be better than that. Now, I do not know what Hasidic sheep means. Does it mean that none of the shochtim daven Ashkenaz? And if so, what does that have to do with the kashrus of the meat? I do not understand it. What is it that disqualifies a person who is not a chassid from being a reliable shochet? I have no idea. I asked the Rav, what is Hasidic shechita? He says, shh, that's one of the great mysteries of our time. Right, Mr.? People see it, that's it. We also, by the way, the glatt business has gone off the wall. I have a friend who owns a bakery. People call up the bakery recently and want to know if the bakery is glatt. You can buy glatt kosher chickens. But the term glatt does not apply to chickens, ladies and gentlemen. It only applies to behemoths. It does not apply to ovens. It does not apply to turkey. OU glatt. I called up Empire. This stuff is OU glatt. Rabashkin Arons, it's OU glatt. Kosher Supreme, OU glatt chicken. Called up the Empire plant. I spoke to one of the meshkichim there. I said to him, what is this word glatt doing on the package? It is meaningless. He said to me, what can I tell you? People were calling up constantly wanting to know if it was glatt. I kept trying to explain to them that that was a meaningless question that had no substance to it. Finally, we got fed up and we put the word on. That doesn't. Now, when Empire got the KAJ, which is Breuer's supervision, there was an article in the Jewish press called Hasidische Chickens. That was the title of the article. Now, I don't know whether those chickens have black feathers, ladies and gentlemen. I just don't know what makes them Hasidish. I have no idea. I do know that Breuer certainly was not a Hasid in the sense that it's used today. He may have been a Hasid in the terminology the way the Gemara uses that term in terms of Hasidus, but he certainly wasn't a Hasid in the common terminology of today. People have to be concerned with terminology, with what makes sense. Why do we put up with it? Why do we put up with it? And then we have another phenomenon here. There was a time in Borough Park and in Flatbush and in Brooklyn in general when many places didn't have any hashgach at all. I don't know if you know that. Actually, I seem to remember years ago the Royale. It was a fascinating place. I was sitting there. It did have hashgach, by the way. I was sitting there with the editor of a kashrus publication. He's eating, and I'm eating. And I turned to him and I said to him, "What is hashgach in here?" So he says, "Dr. Levine, please tell me." I did. I never go anywhere without asking. And if I've been there on Monday, and I'm going to go on Tuesday, I will call up also and ask the second time. Why? I want the person who is paying good money for that supervision to know that somebody cares. I went into a store in Flatbush not long ago. They had a certain kind of potato kugel that was inexpensive and we felt was very tasty. It disappeared. They didn't have it anymore. They had a new kind of potato kugel under a certain rabbi who I don't use. So I asked the owner of the store, what happened to the other potato kugel? He said, the company went out of business. I said to him, well, I don't use that supervision that you have on there. He says to me, that rabbi doesn't give the hashgacha. I said to him, what are you talking about? He says to me, I said, his name is on it. He says, his name is on it, but he doesn't give the hashgacha. I said, what are you talking about? I mean, his name is on it. I said, who does give the hashgacha? He says, I do. This is the owner of the store. I said, and what qualifies you to give hashgacha? He says, I'm a nice Jewish boy. I called up another place here in Borough Park. They have a takeout. I asked him, who did that call? He says, Rabbi something or other. Who is he? He's the head of a kollel. So I said to him, we have a kollel and he's the head of it. So I said to him, what qualifications does he have to give us? Because ladies and gentlemen, let's understand something. Today, food technology is extraordinarily complicated. You need a great deal of information to know. There's nothing that's innocent anymore. In fact, somebody I know who's involved in kashrus told me the more natural a product is, the more trouble it can have. What are his qualifications? He says, so don't eat it, and he hung up on me. So I say to you, and it, by the way, it's the public, it's us who are responsible for allowing this situation to be, because we don't ask. We don't seem to care. People just go, everybody else is. I knew there was a place that no longer exists here in Borough Park. Caterer and Paul had no hashkofa at all. When I called up, the guy called up several times, told me, I give my own hashkofa, number one. You may say to me, what's wrong? He's an observant fellow. He gives his supervision. What do I have to worry about? There's a tshuva from the Chassam Sofer. Now listen carefully, ladies and gentlemen. There was a fellow who was a shochet. He was known as a reliable shochet. His shechita was accepted. He decided to open a butcher shop and he said, I don't need any supervision. Why not? I'm trusted when it comes to the shechita. Why should I have to have any supervision on the butcher shop? The shaila came to the Chassam Sofer, and the Chassam Sofer said he does need hashkofa on the butcher shop. Why? Because when it comes to the butcher shop, he's no gay of the dog. He's involved monetarily. When he chefs the behemoth, if it's kosher, good, if it's not kosher, he still gets his salary as a shochet no matter what. So it might well be, ladies and gentlemen, that I would eat in somebody's house, but I wouldn't eat from their store unless they have appropriate hashkofa. We have to look at them. Guy told me, this guy from this place, he didn't have any hashkofa. He said to me at one point, he said, if you think I need hashkofa, you're not a maimon. A well-known rabbi made a chasana there. I called up. I got the invitation. I called up. I always call up, by the way. And by the way, why isn't the supervision on the invitation? Why isn't the supervision posted at the Kiddush on Shabbos? Why isn't it? Why isn't it? Ask the waiter sometimes. I don't know. Comes from so. I don't know. I don't know. It's a mystery. So, well, no, I made a chasana, he invited me to the chasana, so I called up. The guy told me there's no supervision. I knew from before, because I spoke to him before. So I spoke to this rabbi, I said to him, the brother's chasana is coming up, and you're making it. I said, what supervision does he have? So he stops and he looks at me. He said, he doesn't have any. He says, he must. I said, he does not. I spoke to him yesterday, he told me no. He says, I have to look into it, I'll get back to you. Went by 1 week, went by 2 weeks. Now, I'm a tenacious fellow. I don't let things just go away. I cornered him 2 weeks later and he said to me, what we're going to do is we're going to bring in a mashgiach. So I looked him straight in the eye and said to him, are you going to kasher the whole place? So he walked away. I didn't go to the chasana. But there was on the table a little card saying that Rabbi so-and-so gave the supervision, and a friend of mine who went came back and told me, I know why that card was there, because of you. Because of you.
And he was in a shul.
What?
I mean, the whole place is in the synagogue.
No, it wasn't a shul. It wasn't, and even if it is a shul, who is giving the supervision? Who is? Is that person qualified? He can be a tremendous Talmud Chacham. I'm not saying that anybody's going to do anything wrong intentionally. Chas v'chalila. But do they know enough to give supervision? Years ago, I was invited to a shavuot. I called up. The caterer said, I don't have any hashkofa. I use only haimusha products. I don't know what that means, by the way. That's another one of these terms that are very fluid, okay? There's only haimusha products. I said to him, thank you, and I called up the person making the soup. I said, I can't go to the shavuot because I'm sorry. I don't know what haimusha products mean, and I still don't today. I still don't. Let's move on to something else. You know, we see today people who it's clear that they are Jews, clear that they are observant Jews. There was a time before the war primarily when it was not so easy to see who was, particularly with men, who was really, as many men didn't wear yarmulkes in public. I'm not faulting them. If you go to the courts, this is courts, you'll see that many of the old-time lawyers don't wear yarmulkes. The younger folks do wear yarmulkes. It's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. People are not afraid to show what they are and who they are. It's a wonderful thing. The women dress appropriately. But ladies and gentlemen, let's understand something. If they can tell that you are an observant Jew, that means that they're going to judge all of Orthodoxy by how you behave. If you look like a schlump, if you walk around with a dirty shirt, if you can't open your mouth and say hello, if you can't say thank you in a store, they're going to say this is what Torah Judaism is. And that's not what it is. It is not that at all. At West Point, where I spent a year, the cadets had it hammered into them that when you wore that uniform, you had to behave in a certain way. And the same thing is true about each and every one of us. And make no mistake, they can tell who you are. In the summertime, it's clear who the observant women are. It's clear. It's painfully obvious, okay? The way you behave, the way you, whether you say thank you, whether you greet people. I had a couple of friends who came here from London. They were staying in Borough Park. Observant people. We went out to eat with them. He says to me, what's wrong with this place? This isn't fun. Nobody says hello to me. I go to shul, and nobody can even bother to say good morning. I walk in the streets, nobody says, there have been countless letters, particularly in the Jewish press, that on Shabbos, people can't seem to open up their mouths and say good Shabbos. Now, there's a Mishnah, I don't understand, it's in Perkei Avos. Adi mekavo kol adam besav upon the office. You should greet every person with a smile. And then it mentions that this one used to greet even Gentiles. I say good Shabbos to everybody. Now, I happen to be, I daven early. So I'm coming home from shul when most people are going to shul. So they're probably sleeping a little bit, but I watch. Some of them are the mumblers. They can't, they're mumbling, I don't know. Some of them are kind of making sure they can't step on the cracks, or they're looking there. They can't seem to get out a simple good Shabbos. A simple good Shabbos. Well, one year, hey, it was Pesach, this second day of whatever it was, I'm walking to shul, and a black fellow's coming the other way, catches me. I say to him, good morning. He says to me, good morning to you, sir, and happy festival. I said to him, thank you. What did that cost me, ladies and gentlemen? And hopefully it built a little bit of goodwill. Hopefully. So we have to be concerned about how we behave, how we look, that we shouldn't push in line, that we shouldn't be obnoxious. We have to train our children. I walk out of shul, and there's a 10-year-old that zips through the door before me. I stop and I say, excuse me, sir, I'm a little older than you are. He looks at me, has no idea, no sense of what I'm talking about. What are you, how were you raised? What is going on with you? An older person should go. I was brought up that no older person was ever called by their first name. It was either Mr. or Mrs. or aunt or uncle, but everybody had a title. And I'm adamant. I was adamant with that in my own children, and my children know it, so my grandchildren. I have a son whose name is Simcha. So my grandchildren from another son call him Uncle Simcha. However, the son who has these children has a good friend by the name of Simcha. So what to call him? Because you already have one Uncle Simcha. So they call him not Uncle Simcha. But at least he's got a title. He's not called by his first name. I'll never forget. My son once had a guest for Shabbos. He was 11, 10 or 11 or 12, something like that. And after Shabbos, I said to him, what are you going to do? His parents were away. What are you going to do now? He says, I'm going to call Shloimeh. He's going to pick me up. Who's Shloimeh? He's my uncle. To me, it's not right, ladies and gentlemen. Now, maybe I'm old-fashioned. Maybe I'm from a different thing. But these things are important. Another thing. We live in a time in which people are sincerely interested in Torah knowledge. It's wonderful. We have yeshivas. We have shiurim. We have all sorts of things. We'll speak about yeshiva education in a moment. But now we have in the world, Kabbalah. This is the latest thing. Kabbalah. Do you know that on a website there's even the Kabbalah of knitting? There's a website called Kosher Kabbalah, so I must assume there has to be a non-kosher Kabbalah site, but I couldn't find it. There, the whole idea, a red string, a this, a that. Now, when Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was asked why he didn't study Kabbalah, he responded as follows. He said, what need do I have to know in which sphere the Shechina is? I know that if I do not live my life properly in this world, I will be punished. That's all I have to know. I don't have to know anything more than that. Now, Kabbalah was traditionally only something for very special people. It is extremely esoteric. It certainly wasn't something for the masses. But it is everywhere. It is everywhere. We have also something called today the Torah codes, the Bible codes. Wrote an article about this in the Hamodi, and I got some flack back from somebody. And because there's a gentleman named Dr. Barry Simon, who is a super professor at California Institute of Technology. He's a Frum guy. And he has several articles showing that statistically it ain't so. You can do the same thing with War and Peace. You can predict the assassination of Lincoln and a Princess Di and who knows who else. Okay? It's all there if you know how to do it. All there if you know how to do it. So, the Hamodia had something about somebody looked in the use of the methods of the Torah codes and she was able to see the events that had happened to her were verified. I wrote against it. I quoted this guy Barry Simon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody wrote back an article, and now this is the typical, you see this in the articles. One of the articles to rebut me start off as, I was really disappointed that a newspaper like the Hamodia would publish such an article as the one by Dr. Levine about the Torah codes. See, this is, first of all, the PC Haredi approach. How could you, by the way, this past week also, they published something, nothing less, but how could the newspaper even think that he does it? How could the newspaper? If the newspaper is interested in an open exchange of ideas, then sometimes you're going to publish something that's going to ruffle some feathers. Otherwise, you have mediocrity. You have nothing. It's blah. It has no time. It has no soil. Life is discussion. The Gemara didn't back away from difficult issues. So I then answered back a second thing because I had what to answer back. In a moment I'm going to read you something that Rav Shach said about this, but it seems today that the more fantastic the story, there was the talking fish in Muncie, remember that? Remember the talking fish in Muncie? Off the wall! The more fantastic, the more off the wall, the more people run after it. I recall that when Rav Shimon Schwab, Zechatarikli Rafa, was told something that women do as a quote-unquote schooler during pregnancy, he said, my mother never knew about this, and my grandmother never knew about this, and my great-grandmother never knew about this. They are making up a religion. And ladies and gentlemen, in some circles, in certain things, they are making up a religion. Let me read to you, if I may, maybe I won't read all of it, what Rav Shach said. This is from a book called Conversations with Rav Shach. By the way, I didn't know that this was there when I wrote my two articles in the Hamodi, otherwise I would have just dropped this on them. As is well known, Rav Shach strongly objected to any preoccupation with modern-day prophecies, calculations of the end of days, divots, transmigrations and elevation of souls, and other paranormal phenomena. He often declared that it is forbidden for anyone to determine any course of action based on these kinds of quote-unquote information, especially nowadays when there are so many charlatans who deliberately mislead people with their quote-unquote knowledge. Furthermore, he said, we do not have any authority to introduce in our generation practices and customs that we did not receive as part of our tradition from our forefathers and rabbis. For the same reason, he expressed his disapproval of the various systems of finding allusions to contemporary events or facts for instance, quote, Torah quotes, unquote, whereby secret messages are, quote, discovered, unquote, in the Torah by joining together letters that appear at a given interval in the text, skipping over letters, etc., as well as of miracle workers and supposed mekubalim and future tellers, future tellers who tell people how to attain rectification for their souls based on arbitrary contrived nonsense. What need do we have for such people, he would ask, when every person can easily find out what his duty is in the world by reading the ordinary classical text of Musar and other inspirational works. He goes on more, but I think you get the gist. He certainly was not in favor of these things. By the way, Brother Victor Miller, whom I knew well, was also very much opposed to it. Whenever I would mention something like this to him, he would go, we are not mechuyev to believe these stories. So, this he said several, I told him a number of different things. In fact, I even told him something that has a very, very solid source, and he pushed it away, and we are not mechuyev. So I said to him, Rav Miller, I don't understand. Everything like this, you push away. You push it away. He said the following to me. I didn't understand the full impact of what he was saying until later. He said to me, our emunah is strained enough by what we have to believe. To add more to it is dangerous. Now, at that time, I was not familiar with the history of Shabtai Tzvi. Ladies and gentlemen, I spoke about that here. That movement swept the Jewish world. And one of the things that fed it was the fact that people were willing to accept the most unbelievable of stories. The wildest of things were accepted. We have today, and I'll just touch on it, a messianic movement in the Orthodox world. You know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the movement in Chabad. How widespread it is, when, where, and how, no one can tell you. My son told me proudly yesterday that he did meet a Lubavitcher who said that he didn't believe the Lubavitcher Rebbe was Mashiach, and he also didn't believe that he could be Mashiach. By the way, it's not enough for them to say, or that many of them dodged the question. I once asked the fellow, do you believe Lubavitcher Rebbe is Mashiach? He said to me, I sure hope so. I said to him, you didn't answer my question. I asked him again, I sure hope so. He didn't answer yet. I sure hope. Then he said to me finally, I'm not going to say what you want to hear. By the way, why did I call him? Because he was behind a shkoch on a certain product that somebody had given me. And once I saw his background, I called him up to find out. Okay? Many of them will not answer that question. They will push you here and push you there. A friend of mine...
Excuse me, don't disregard that.
The same fellow whose bakery is being queried to see if it's glatt told me that he came back from Eretz Israel a few days ago, and there sat next to him a woman in her 60s who believed his words 110% that Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson is still alive. He did not die. By the way, they say Shabtai Tzvi never died. There are tremendous parallels between these two movements. Tremendous parallels that are really kind of scary. Let's talk about just a couple of other things. Another thing I'd like to talk about is yeshiva education. There is absolutely no comparison to the yeshivas that we have today to the ones in the past that we had here in America. If you know anything about the history of Jewry in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 20s, what killed young people was the fact that they went to public school. Even the most observant of parents, outside of New York, they weren't. I happen to be familiar with a place called Chelsea, Massachusetts, which is where Rabbi Victor Miller was rubbed from 1939 to 1944. I was born in Chelsea, okay? So I know something about Chelsea, and I know what went on. Rav Miller was involved in the founding of a day school there, but before that, there were Malamdim, and there was this, and there was that, but it was Hefka. The children were lost. Today we have wonderful institutions. We do, and we have a choice, okay? And even in outside of New York, I think in any town or any city with 5,000 or 10,000 Jews, Talmudsaurus says, you'll find a Hebrew day school going at least up to the 8th grade. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And we have people who are sincerely devoted to teaching our children. And they suffer for it, ladies and gentlemen, because they are paid, relatively speaking, peanuts, let's be honest. And they sacrifice, and they devote themselves to it, and they really put their heart and soul in it. On the other hand, at least here in Brooklyn and other places, our children are being short shrifted when it comes to their secular education. We are churning out ignorant kids. They cannot read, they cannot write, they do not know their times table. I asked a boy tonight, he's a 10th grader in a middle of the road school, what decimal is equivalent to 20%? He says 0.4. He doesn't know how to do fractions. He doesn't have the basis of the sixth grade. Now, some kids certainly do. But the fact of the matter is that there's a negative attitude towards secular subjects in our yeshivas. A very negative attitude. And by the way, that is not the attitude that was prevalent years ago. What do I mean by that? When I took my oldest son to Torah Vadas to see if he would be admitted, one of the people we met was Rabbi Lerner, who was the English principal, Zeichu Livracha. Rabbi Lerner was a secular educated person. He had an advanced degree in mathematics. When he found out that I had a PhD in mathematics, he got all excited. So he started to tell me, you know, what they teach in the math, in this grade, in this grade, in this grade, and how he has the best teachers, and blah, 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 blah. So then I said to him, Rabbi Lerner, what happens in grade 12? He became crestfallen. He said to me, what can I tell you, Dr. Levine? It's not like it was years ago when I used to give an extra class in math after yeshiva, and boys like Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Steinwurzel used to stay after to attend that class. It's not like that. Now, if you do not turn out a product that has basic skills to function in the world, they will not be able to function in the workplace. And let's be honest, ladies and gentlemen, the vast, vast majority of young people, even if they spend 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever, they eventually go to work, right? We hope they go to work. I mean, it says, they're supposed to work. That's not something that's reprehensible. I wrote an article about secular subjects in yeshiva. I have gotten a huge, huge response to that article. I even got that article appeared quite a while ago, and I got an email this week about it. Now, one fellow sent me an email a while ago that he works for the government of Baltimore, and he works in human resources, and he places people in various government jobs. And he says invariably gets people who are leaving the yeshiva who come to him and want a job. And he said, I can't place them because they don't have the fundamental skills. They can't read, they can't write, and they can't speak. Can't listen to the radio. As soon as you hear a talk show, you can immediately tell if it's an observant fellow on the phone. Almost invariably. Why? Because you can't speak it. Can't speak language. Forget about spelling. Now, that time in yeshiva is designated for secular subjects. Why not do something constructive with it? Let's make it count. I heard a story a number of years ago about a couple of boys who were in the main yeshiva. Wouldn't behave in the afternoon. And no matter what the teachers did, and no matter what the English principal did, was no hope. They wouldn't. They were excellent in learning, but they were not cooperating. So they finally took them to the old Rav Kalmanovich. And Rav Kalmanovich said the following to them. When the Gedolim decided to allow secular subjects in the yeshiva, they gave time off from learning so that you should study secular subjects. If you waste that time, that is bittul Torah. That is bittul Torah. You hear? That's a waste of the time Torah. One more thing, and then we're going to stop. And that is what I will call intolerance. There is an attitude of intolerance in our, in certain segments of our world. Now, again, we have a huge amount of chesed. I know of a family that always davens very early on Rosh Hashanah, and then they go around to the hospitals and they blow shofar. This family is involved in all sorts of things. They don't want any publicity. And the boy said to me, if you write my name in the article, don't ever write my name in the article. I wrote about him quietly. No name. They don't want anything. They want to do the mitzvah. Tremendous things. But we have a tendency today to judge people by externalities. You know, there's the story, you may have heard this story, that Mashiach decided it's time to come. Mashiach is coming. So he gets ready, he comes down here, he walks into a shul, and he says, I'm Mashiach. They look at him and said, you're wearing a hat with a turned down brim. Mashiach can't have a hat with a turned down brim. He's got to have an up hat, otherwise he can't be Mashiach. Well, he walks out, he gets an up hat, he goes into another shul, he says, I'm Mashiach. They look at him, Mashiach with a hat? You got to have a knitted yarmulke. You can't have a hat. You can't be Mashiach. And the story goes on and on and on until finally he says, I'm leaving. So they all come running after him. No, we want Mashiach. We want Mashiach. Let me to flip this. So he says, no, you don't want Mashiach. You're obsessed with externalities. I know of a case of a very fine fellow. Now he's married, Baruch Hashem, with a family and children. A girl refused to go out with him because she found out that he didn't wear black suits exclusively. This was the litmus test. He was excellent in learning at fine midos. He didn't wear black suits. Forget it. Finished. And the shidduch scene today, which from what I understand is an absolute nightmare for many people, is obsessed with externalities. There's a matrix, a checkbox, check, 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 and you think, boom, then it comes out, okay? If you look at the pictures of the way yeshiva boys looked in Europe, they don't look like yeshiva boys today. They do not. I wrote about this also. I wrote, you look at the pictures of the boys from Tel Aviv, the boys from... In fact, my wife, who's here, is related to, by marriage, to Manfred Lehman, Zechel of Rock, who's no longer. Manfred Lehman was a very successful businessman. He got a PhD in rare Jewish manuscripts. He did work in that, and he wrote many, many articles for the Morgan Journal and other places. So he wrote an article about when he came to Ne Yisrael in 1941. He says there were about 70 boys there. There were no black suits. There were no black hats. There were no beards, there were no payers, there were no chassidim. Why? He said it was felt to be an ostentatious show of piety to wear these things. This was the mere musr. You hear? This was the mere musr. And therefore, people didn't do it. Now, the world has changed. But still, to judge everybody by an externality, it's crazy. It's crazy. And by the way, this judging externality, this intolerance goes so far as to lead to violence. I don't know if you're aware that in the Panovich Yeshiva, there were fights. There were fights, literally fights in the Panovich Yeshiva. I know people were arrested in Williamsburg because they didn't like people using the Erev on Shabbos. Isn't that a Kiddush Hashem when 20-some-odd Hasidim are arrested, booked, and fingerprinted on Shabbos? Protesting? I don't understand it. And by the way, let's not think that intolerance is just on the right wing end. If you go into virtually any young Israel and speak against Zionism, if I were to say publicly the statement that Rav Schwab said, first of all, let's understand something. Rav Schwab said, we are not in favor of flag burners. We are not in favor of those ads that are put in the New York Times, which represent nobody. Okay? But he said, the fact of the matter is that Zionism is the antithesis of Judaism. The antithesis. Because Zionism was an attempt to change what it meant to be a Jew, to pull the Jew away from his religious roots. It changed. Religious Zionism is something else. But that's what Zionism was originally. Herzl with his big black beard, ain't no yarmulke on his head, ladies and gentlemen. You look at the picture, you know. Herzl, by the way, proposed to the Pope the mass conversion of European Jewry. He was going to help lead it. That would solve the Jewish problem. Now, I say the following. From what I can see, there are at least 4 million Jews in Eretz Israel, and their lives are on the line today. Make no mistake, the Arabs do not want peace, ladies and gentlemen. They do not want peace. They want to drive the Jews out, whether it be kill them, push them into the sea. They want to get rid of them. And by the way, that's only the first step. Then they want to take over the whole world. You know, anything about Islam and its conquering of the world, this is a fact. So I say the following. I don't care what your politics are. You're a Zionist, you're not a Zionist, that. You've got to make sure that whatever you do supports those people there. They need it. Their lives are at stake. I'm going to close with the following. The Chofetz Chaim said, maybe 70, 80 years ago, that we're living in the time of Mashiach. If the Mashiach is here. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following. Rabbi Naroi said, in the generation when the son of David, that's Mashiach, will come, young people will shame the elderly. And the elderly will rise before young people. A daughter will stand against her mother. And a daughter-in-law will stand against her mother-in-law. The face of the generation will be like the face of a dog. Pnei ha-dor ki pnei ha-kelev. And a son will not be embarrassed before his father. Rabbi Yisrael Salantin, what does it mean? Pnei ha-dor ki pnei ha-kelev. That the face of the generation will be like the face of a dog. He said the following. He said, if you look and you see a man walking the dog, so you might think that the dog is leading the man, right? That's what it looks like. The dog's in front, the guy with the leash is in the back, who's in charge? But the man, with a little indication on the leash, steers the dog where he wants the dog to go. So he says, that's what it'll be in the time of Mashiach when it comes to our leaders. They won't actually lead, they're going to follow what they think the people want. Rather than set an example, they will follow the whim and of the people, whatever they want. Now, we have some wonderful leaders. We have some wonderful leaders. But we have to support them. We have to support them, and we have to stay away from what I consider to be some of the madness. We have to focus on the good, and we have to concentrate. And in that way, in Ezer Hashem, the Orthodox community will continue to grow and to improve. I thank you.
That was a beautiful talk. That was a beautiful thought. Just a minute, please. Just a minute. I'm surprised the house had turned into blood over here.
It wasn't mass applause. It was just that guy making a lot of noise in the corner.
Okay. I didn't. Okay, forgive me for.
If applause is the protocol, I would applaud, but usually we do not applaud, therefore I did not applaud.
Okay, I'm only. Anyway, I apologize to Larry. I didn't mean to embarrass him.
Didn't matter.
Okay, thank you. You're very generous, and it was a beautiful talk. I appreciated it. And we will make copies of the talk, and who has a question? Okay, Sally will ask the first question. Mr. Pomeranz, Sauer, Cohen, Zarkane will ask the second question. Larry, the third question. Professor Schiffer will ask the fourth question. Is there another question?
No question, comment.
Okay, and Representative Gittles. I consider you a Robinson, but you look like a Robinson. Okay, you're left with that question. I have a question. I'll ask the sixth question. Okay, you'll, Caroline will ask the sixth question, and, I'll ask the seventh question. I would just like to say...
I may not be here by then.
I am so proud that Dr. Levine is my friend. I'm very proud.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
I want to thank you for having the courage to let me talk about this subject, because not everybody will.
Yeah. Okay. First question, Sally.
Okay. My question is, is wasting water making up for nutrition also? Or both a little different?
I went
somewhere, I won't say which house, it very wasn't that much. And they asked, is your water filtered? She said, the rest of them said, no. She didn't apologize. She said,
look. Let a couple of things. First of all, I am not a Pisic, and so it's not up to me to say you should filter your water or you shouldn't filter your water. And my own personal practices, as my wife will testify, are off the wall anyway. But since I do them and I don't impose them on anything, that's totally different. Now, let me focus on one little piece of this. You know, there were these pictures in these articles of women burning chaitas. Now, and it looked like a scene out of the Middle Ages. It makes us look like medieval, I don't know what. Now, I say the following. If you want to burn your shekel, go into your backyard quietly, start a little fire, drop it in, and that's it. Why do you have to go out into the middle of the street, gather hundreds of people around, and throw them in the fire so that the press will see this? Am I missing something, ladies and gentlemen? Is there something wrong with it? You know, I don't know. You know, there are three controversies. There was the shekel, there was the water, and there was the eruv. So they said the solution to all problems is the following. You take the shekel, and you wash it in the water, and you hang it on the eruv to dry. That solves everything.
Okay. Second question, Colleen.
You touched upon an issue, a very important issue which nobody ever really discusses, and that is the identity of the Mashiach. When the Mashiach, first of all, the Mashiach comes, he's not going to come to Brooklyn, is he? And in the second place, even if he comes to Brooklyn, how are we going to identify him and know he's the Mashiach?
There exists a marvelous book which I just began to read. I ordered it from Targum Press. I don't have any money invested in Targum Press. I didn't write the book. It's a book called On Eagle's Wings by a gentleman named Herschel Brand, B-R-A-N-D. And it talks about how you know who the Mashiach is, what the prophet is the Mashiach, what will happen in the days of the Mashiach, what will happen leading up to it. It is a fascinating read. Now, you can buy it on the internet. You go to www.targum.com. I'm sure you can buy it in a bookstore. And you put in Brand, B-R-A-N-D is the author's name. It cost me $21 or $22 plus a $3 or $4 shipping, and I'm finding it fascinating. And it deals with all of these questions. And that, to me, is a good source. It has Haskama from Rabbi Aaron Feldman from Ne Yisrael. And in his Haskama, he says that this book identifies the characteristics of what the Mashiach has to have, and in our time, it is perhaps almost as important to know what Mashiach isn't as to who he is. So, I recommend that book. It's okay. A readable book.
Thank you very much. Good question.
Can you repeat
good
the name of the book?
Yeah, on Eagle's Wings. Brand, B-R-A-N-D, Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M, Press, Targum, www.targum.com. But if you go, I'm sure, to any bookstore here, they'll have this book.
On Eagle's Wings?
Yes.
By Herschel Brand, okay. Thank you, and Larry.
Okay, as a Talmud of Rav Miller, you're probably one of the few people I can say this to, but please don't think I'm patronizing you by saying that you are anticipating an approval or an agreement. But when you were talking about the chutzpah and about, I think it's a little bit related to revisionism in a way, but it's more behavioral. You know, I mean, I've noticed you're talking about all the chutzpahdik things and lack of respect in the Orthodox world. I've noticed personally, Rabbi Miller once said that in his entire life he never made a sound, an untoward sound, during tefillah. And when you think about it, a 92-year-old man, he means he never coughed, he never cleared his throat or anything. I go to shuls and people are blowing their nose at like deafening decibels in the middle of Shmona Esrei, and they don't think they did anything wrong. I hate to draw the analogy, but it's like an animal who goes to the bathroom in the middle of your living room and just sits there like, you know, pet me on the head. I don't know what I did. I mean, and then there are shuls that have...
what is your question?
My question is... No, it's really a comment, but I want to know...
No, we don't allow bad mouthing here.
What, we just heard about an hour of work?
No.
I hope not. It wasn't...
I'm only kidding. But my question is...
If that's the way it came out, then I apologize.
I have to phrase things... What? Slut didn't give me a break. I have to phrase everything in the form of a question.
The question is,
am I being... hallucinatory? I mean, do I have a right to expect people, just because they're Orthodox, to have manners? Or I cannot say to them, which I've done many times, you know, every shvaka on the train covers their mouth when they cough, why don't you? I mean, am I out of line, or what's the story here?
You see, you can't just focus on individuals. I've gotten on buses, and I've had yeshiva boys and yeshiva girls. I mean, I do have a white beard now. Get up to me and give me a seat. And I've also had plenty who didn't, okay? I've had black boys and girls get up and give me a seat, and plenty who didn't. So you can't just focus on the ones that you see that don't do it. Yeah, it's the person more.
Too many of them.
Well, it could be that we are not emphasizing these sorts of things strongly enough in our education. That could well be. But you see, most of this has to come from the home. It has to come from the home. A child has to be taught to say thank you. A child has to know when his mother serves him something, he should appreciate it. My kids used to ask, what's for dinner? I said, do you have a contract guaranteeing you that you have dinner? Who said you have guaranteed for dinner? You have to, you know, be thankful for dinner. And by the way, Baruch Hashem, we don't live in those times, but it wasn't so long ago that people sometimes didn't know what the next meal was going to be. They really didn't. They lived very difficult lives. So the home is really the starting point. Okay? The home is the starting point. Now, And also, let me just say something then, okay? I had an incident that disturbed me, okay? What was it? There is in Flatbush a certain store that has a little parking lot near it, but when you go in, you can't, it's really very difficult to back up, you have to go all the way through. So there's a woman sitting there in a big car, a young woman with a shape, obviously an observant woman. And I pull in, and she doesn't move. Which means I can't go forward, I can't go back, because the back out of the traffic is coming the other way. So I honk. She doesn't move. I honk. She doesn't move. She rolls down the window, and she opens up her mouth to me and says, I'm not moving until I get a parking spot. I'm waiting here until somebody leaves. So I said to the lady, what am I supposed to do? It's dangerous for me to back up. I don't care. Now, what kind of a child is going to come from such a home? On the other hand, there are some marvelously fine people. And there are some marvelously fine young people, and you meet them. Don't think you don't. So, I think you know, again, as my wife said, that's not Yiddishkeit, that is the upbringing.
Uh-huh.
That is the upbringing, okay? And listen, I teach in a secular college, and I have some marvelously fine Gentile students. Derek Harris, everything. And I have others. When I was a student, I would never have thought to do this. Say I'm lecturing, so I have 90 or 100 students in a lecture. And it's a day I'm giving out an exam. So I call out the names, and then there are some who come late. I would never have thought in my wildest dreams when I was a student to walk into the class, walk right in front of the lecture, and start looking through the exams. I said to the kid, I said, what are you doing? I said, Nobody wants you to see their score. You're going to see the scores on it. Who would have thought of this? There are other kids who would never think to do such a thing. So really, it's a function of upbringing, maybe of culture, etc. Please.
No, I just want to say,
he's a tough guy. He's a tough guy. What can I tell you?
No.
Interesting.
No, I don't care. Okay. We forgive her outburst. Okay.
Mutter lost.
Okay.
Interesting point.
Larry was the fourth, I think, right?
Third.
Okay, it was the fourth person, Professor Shifra.
Okay, I want to thank you so much for your feeling so much for us to think about.
What is your question?
I'm thinking for a minute.
Okay, we'll get back to it.
I know what my question is. Just a moment, please. Thinking about the kashrus, and I know this could be just going through the shir, but the whole aspect of the lackadaisical attitude of the kashrus, do you think that the, and could you just do it in a summary form? What is the meaning? What happens to us? I know that's a big question, but the reason I'm saying it, just give us a briefing
let me say something.
There?
Not that I don't want to go there. I can't go there, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. I consider myself, if you haven't guessed, a misnagim. If you haven't guessed, I'll admit it publicly. I'm willing to admit publicly.
I got it.
I'm not of a Hasidic bent. Okay?
That's a Hasidic question.
No. Well, that there are certain answers in Kabbalah which I simply don't understand. Okay.
Okay. Very important.
The fact of the matter is that we should be concerned that what we consume is indeed kosher. We have a right that if it's okay, and I think people should spend a little bit more time investigating rather than simply going, you know. Again, I happen to personally, we never go to any simcha, never go to anything unless I know who gives, who's catering it, and who gives the hashgacha. I will not go. My wife knows it well. We didn't go to 3 chasanas recently because of that. Okay. Now, I'm not saying that my standards are the standards that everybody should have, because
I
have that.
I want to understand.
No, no.
You tell your privacy. You're not,
all right,
forget that question. I understand what you're saying.
But at least you should know, I'll give you an example. Years ago, I used to daven in the shul. They had a kiddush. So I asked the rabbi of the shul, where does the cake come from and who gives the hashgacha? He says to me, it's yoshin. I said to him, I'm not concerned with it being yoshin. I want to know if it's kosher. Who gives the hashgacha? He didn't know. Then, a few weeks later, I saw that he allowed a person to bring in fish that was made in their own home into the shul. Now, I lived in Elizabeth for 6 years. You couldn't bring a toothpick into a shul in Elizabeth. I came here to glorious Brooklyn, and everybody's heimish. And who says that my standards are your standards? Why should I be allowed to bring anything from my home into shul? But you see it all the time. Why? I don't understand it. Am I missing something? Shouldn't there be certain kashrus? In some shuls there are. There's a list of approved bakeries, of approved this, of approved caterers, and those are the ones, okay? You want to have some fun? The next time you go to a simcha, you ask the people around you, who gives the supervision here? Who's the caterer? Where's it coming from? Whose meat are they using? Whose bread are they using? Okay? What kind of vegetables? Who's the mashgiach? They'll look at you off the wall. They'll look at you.
Okay. Question was asked and answered. It's difficult for me to project my voice. Recall Mrs. Weissman, your friend and ours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I just want to, you know, to make a comment of Bob Sureva. Bob Sureva, I saw a video on him many years ago, and he was, you know, giving his address or whatever, and then at the end he said, I've done everything I can to bring Mashiach, now it's up to you. He did not say he's Mashiach.
Okay. I can show you videos on the internet in which he's accepting thousands of signatures by the women of Lubavitch that he is Mashiach. He's accepting the Mashiach tambourine. For at least the last 10 to 15 years of his life, he hinted that he was Mashiach. He may not have come out and said openly, but he hinted. He certainly never squelched it. He did not come out and squelch it.
I've done everything I can to bring Mashiach.
I'll show you the videos.
Okay. Let's move on, please. Caroline.
I just wanted you to bring up the subject of something that you mentioned. That you said that the parallel between the Sabbatai and Lavin.
Sabbatai and the Messianic movement, yeah, the Kavan. First of all, the false Shabbatai Tzvi believed that he never died. Does that sound familiar? Okay. He was, actually I think Shabbatai Tzvi was accepted perhaps by even more of what it was. Now Shabbatai Tzvi spawned a huge tshuva movement at the time. A huge tshuva movement, by the way, which is one of the prerequisites for Mashiach coming. And the claim is that Lubavitch Rebbe also has spawned a huge tshuva movement. Even after Shabbatai Tzvi died, better than that, because this doesn't apply to Lubavitch, I don't mean to make an analogy. Shabbatai Tzvi, you know, converted to Islam. Okay. He had followers who would not abandon him. There's a book called Glucko of Hemlin. And she writes that her father-in-law had packed supplies to go to Palestine. He had casks of stuff, all packed up, and for 3 years after Shabbatai Tzvi converted, he would not unpack them. He couldn't believe that it wasn't so. There were many secret followers of Shabbatai Tzvi who denied it, but they were secret followers. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who was one of the people who spent his time ferreting out these people, very other people said that he had a friend who met a fellow who sat and learned day and night. He fasted several days a week. He was very wealthy. He was a bucky in Gomorrah, and he admitted to this friend of Yaakov Emden that he ate hummus on Pesach. Why? Because part of the Shabbatai Tzvi movement was that in order to fulfill the Torah, you have to break the Torah. Why did he convert to Islam? Because when, and I don't understand this, I'm telling you up front now, I'm repeating words, when Adam HaRishon did the Chet, he scattered certain sparks of Kedusha throughout the world, and they're mixed in with evil. So Shabbatai Tzvi had to descend into the evil of Islam in order to redeem. So they did Chatoyim in order to redeem the sparks. Now, this is not, of course, true with Lubavitch at all. I don't mean to make an analogy, but the fact that they wouldn't admit what they were. Okay, push Lubavitch. Ask him. I asked the fellow Lubavitch. I said, do you believe Lubavitch? Another one. Yes, Lubavitch Rebbe is Mashiach. He said, I believe everything Lubavitch Rebbe ever said is true. I said to him, one more time, do you believe Lubavitch Rebbe is Mashiach? I believe everything Lubavitch Rebbe ever said is true. After five times. I said to him, you didn't answer the question. That's all I'm going to say. Then I saw a review of David Berger's book, The Messiah, the Rebbe, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. And a fellow by the name of Kermit, who now I think is the Rav of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue in Manhattan, wrote the following. He said that for the last 10 to 15 years of his life, the Lubavitch Rebbe spent his time hinting that he was Mashiach. That's number one. Number two, it is a pillar of Lubavitch Hasidus that he was infallible. He never made a mistake. He was a prophet. He was a this. He was a that. For them to believe that he was wrong, that he was not Mashiach, would remove this pillar of Lubavitch and all of them would go boom. They can't not admit it. There were followers of Shabtai's fee 240 years after he converted in Salonika, the Daimler, okay? I don't see the messianic movement in Lubavitch dying down. By the way, there are three kinds, you know that.
Yes, I understand, but
First of all those who were involved with Shabtai before he converted were all observant Jews.
Yes, but after that
there were two groups. There was the small group of 300 to 400 families that converted in mass to Islam. They became the Daima. Most of them from Salonika. But there was a whole group that went back into the fold of Judaism and remained secret Shabtai Tzvi followers. Yaakov Edman accused Jonas and Abishitz of this. Well, the parallel is that Lubavitch is interwoven through the entire fabric of Orthodoxy today.
Okay.
Now, who is the Messianic, who is not, and who really believes in it? Listen, David Berger says that he came into a shul to daven mincha one day, and a fellow took out a little sitter and a picture of the Rebbe, and he stood there davening like that.
Okay, we can't make this, Caroline, we can't make this a dialogue, okay? Okay, the last question will be asked by myself, as sort of a personal thing. Would you be kind enough to send to me either through email or to the United States mail a copy of your article about the Torah codes?
I have two articles. Sure, it's on my website.
Okay.
Actually, this piece of paper here has most of my articles. It has my website, it has my email address, and it has most of the articles, but I will be more than glad to send the links to you. And if you want to get in touch with me, the best way to get in touch with me is through email.
Okay.
The older I get, the less I like the telephone.
I know, but I don't have money. Oh, let's talk
about it. Okay.
Okay.
Well, my dear friends, we have refreshments on the table, and let's give Dr. Levine began for a salary.
Okay. I know for a fact there's a fellow who lives a few blocks away from me who needed a kidney. He was on dialysis, and if he didn't get a kidney, it was going to be all over. There were ads in the newspapers, and a husband and a wife, independent of each other, independent. She didn't tell him, and he didn't tell her. Both went to be tested, and it turned out that she qualified to be a donor, and she gave him a kidney.
Wow.
And he's walking around today. I see him in shul regularly, okay? And he has a life because this woman did such a thing. This is in our community, ladies and gentlemen.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
I have some woman that needs it very badly. Would you know how she can get it?
No, this I don't know.
She needs a kidney very badly.
This I don't know. But
with this person, obviously.
But do you understand? She's not related to him. She has no connection to him. She didn't even know him. And she did it. It's unbelievable. It is. It's just unbelievable. Thank you again.
Right.